Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our 15th anniversary of the Boston Book Festival. My name's Jeannie Blasberg, and I serve as the co-chair of the board of the Boston Book Festival, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to A Second Heart, Novelists on the Pull of the Past. I support the Boston Book Festival because I love all these amazing author events, and I want to be sure that they will continue on into the future, free to the public. We rely on gifts large and small to make that happen. So if you are enjoying yourself over the course of the day, I encourage you to go online and donate. And today you can even visit our members booth by the library and get some swag if you become a member. After the session, books will be sold outside and authors will be signing. So I encourage you to buy lots of books and spend time with the authors after the session in the room next door. And now I am pleased to introduce the moderator of this morning's session, Margot Livesey.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for being here. It's really great to see so many people coming inside on a beautiful day. And special thanks to Suzanne Burney, whose idea this is, who organized all of us, who proposed many of the wonderful questions that I will be asking. I teach at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and my new novel, The Road from Belhaven, will be published in February. It's an honor to introduce our wonderful panelists. Suzanne Burney is the author of five novels, including The Dogs of Littlefield, and a book of nonfiction. Her first novel, A Crime in the Neighborhood, won Great Britain's Orange Prize. It's now called the Women's Prize. And her most recent novel, The wonderful Blue Window, was published this spring. Elizabeth Graver sadly is indisposed and cannot be with us today. Suzanne and I will be doing our best to present her work. Elizabeth's fifth novel, Cantica, came out in April this year. German and Turkish editions are forthcoming. Her novel, The End of the Point, was longlisted for the 2013 National Book Award, and she's also the author of Awake, The Honey Thief, and Unraveling. Paul Harding's first novel, Tinkers, won the Pulitzer Prize. He is the author of Enon and, most recently, This Other Eden, which is shortlisted for both the Booker Prize and the National Book Award. He does about 27 jobs at Stony Brook, including running the MFA program, and he reads John Locke in his spare time. he also used to be a drummer with a rock band. Rishi Reddy is the author of the novel Passage West, a Los Angeles Times Best California Book for 2020, and the collection Karma and Other Stories, which won the 2008 L.L. Winship Penn New England Award. For 30 years, her day job has been as an environmental lawyer and policymaker. She was most recently the Director of Environmental Justice for the Massachusetts Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs. Probably the longest sentence I'm going to say today. In their very different ways, each of these novels is about the past. The main characters have complex relationships to their own histories, whether they are trying to escape a world they have left or hang on to pieces of that world. And I'm just going to briefly describe the novels before I start asking questions. In Cantica, Elizabeth Graver uses her own family history to explore the story of Sephardic Jews fleeing Turkey in the early 20th century. In This Other Eden, Paul imagines the lives of the mixed-race inhabitants of an island fishing community in early 20th century Maine. In Passage West, Rishi also uses the history of an actual place, the Imperial Valley in California, to create a story about a group of Punjab farmers at the onset of World War I, battling the immigration laws that laid the foundation for US racial dynamics today. Suzanne's The Blue Window explores a central character's repressed memories of her involvement with the Dutch resistance during World War II, and the present-day consequences of that repression to herself and to her family. My own novel, The Road from Belhaven, tells the story of a girl growing up on a farm in 1880s Scotland. It was my COVID novel, written out of my longing to get back to Scotland. My protagonist begins to realize that she can sometimes see the future, but she can never change it. We're going to discuss some of the questions novelists face as they try to bring particular moments of the past into focus. How much past does a character need to seem real? I think, for instance, of Paul Bowles's The Sheltering Sky, which I read recently, in which the characters just leap onto the page completely without any history. And how do you make the past seem relevant and important in our fast-moving world? At the end, there'll be time for your questions, so please be thinking of things you'd like to ask the panelists. And as Jeannie said, they'll be ready and happy to sign books afterwards. Let me start with a question that applies to each of your novels in different ways. How much do you need to know about your characters' past before creating scenes and situations for them? Or does the past start to take shape only once you put them in demanding circumstances? And I should say that the past in these novels takes different forms, two different forms. There's the historical past, the Imperial Valley in 1914, say, or an island off the coast of Maine, and the psychological past, the weight of memory that Marika in Suzanne's The Blue Window carries from her time working in the Dutch resistance. Now, maybe you've forgotten the question after all that, but it's how much do you need to know about your characters' pasts? Someone like to start?
Well, I'll jump in. I think I need usually to know something about where they're from before I start writing, where the physical, geographical place they grew up, something about the time period, and about their family circumstance. And for instance, in The Blue Window, before I started writing, I knew I was going to have a character who was a young teenager in Amsterdam in World War II, working in a very minor way for the Dutch resistance. And I also knew I was going to have her daughter as a character who grew up in the 1960s on a Virginia horse farm. And the vast difference between those places and circumstances was going to be part of the tension. What I didn't know was how that was going to happen, that these are both characters who are trying not to think about things that happened to them during their childhoods, and how I was going to get them to a place where they at least began to start to understand a little bit about what shaped them. And that wasn't until the writing that I got to some of that part.
I guess I could, the way I write is, I take a very long time to write books. It took 10 years to write this other Eden, partly because I don't know anything about the characters. I don't presume anything. Sometimes I know, you know, the geographical, the historical, some of the kind of like broader situations and contexts that they're in. But I'm very empirical. I just start with, you know, often I think of in terms of like photographs. I think of, you know, there's a person. I don't know who that person is, and I just ask, what are you thinking? Where are you? What are you? You know, how are you feeling? What's happening right now? And just spend very, very long time, just, you know, not presuming anything, and sort of allowing the sort of characters to emerge onto the page over many years and many revisions and layers, so that I don't ever force feed them lines that I've made up for them. I always feel like it's my job as a writer to just go into the fictional world with my sort of little notebook, then just shut up and look and listen very carefully and have no preconceived notions or no presumptions about the characters from the very beginning.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that in terms of the length of time. But first, I just want to say thank you all for coming out. This is a great location, and what a great crowd. Thanks for coming out and seeing us. So, Paul, I also take forever to write my books. And I just, one of the things that I think I get hooked on to the past about is it's so hard to sit down and write that first page, to face the blank slate. That a good way for me to sidestep the fear I have around that is to be like, hey, let me just make up a past for this character, and then I can convince myself that I'm working really hard and what I'm really doing is, you know, sort of an adjacent thing to the writing. But actually, as time goes on, it gets interwoven. I can't write without having done that homework at all in the past, because how do you know what your character's quotation or response is going to be in a dialogue without knowing, you know, what that character's backstory is? So that is always a thing that gets braided into the rest of the story, and I keep going back and forth, I think, between the past and then what I think is happening in the present day of the story. I'll also say that for Passage West, because it's an immigrant tale, the notion of what these characters carried from their past and the memory of the country that they came from, you know, whether it was Punjab, Japan, Mexico, Switzerland was, really important to the story and got braided in that psychological way, Margot, that, you know, didn't have direct impact on the characters, but it was the invasive memory that you can't get rid of. So it was important in that way too for the writing.
That's very, very illuminating. Nadine Gordimer talks in writing fiction about the telling gesture that brings her characters to life, and it sounds almost, listening to the three of you, that there's a kind of a telling moment or a telling memory that brings the characters to life. And what creates the most tension for your main characters in relation to their personal history? Are they trying to put the past behind them? Running from Punjab, or running from the island, or are they trying to keep it with them? And does that distinction matter? Any thoughts?
Well, I'd say in my case it's both. And it's a combination for each different character, has a different relationship to their community, their family. Their own past. Some of the characters are trying to get rid of ghosts from their past while they're simultaneously seeing this kind of catastrophe coming over the horizon. And so that's where that tension is. And the characters range, in awareness of, say, this catastrophe that befalls these people on this island, to being almost like a prophet, just understanding exactly what's about to happen, to being relatively sort of unaware of it or innocent. And the other characters, sometimes part of what their struggle is, or their the dramatic tension is, do they let the other characters know, or do they keep them innocent? Is it a where's the ethical and moral where's the to do the right thing for the other their family members and the rest of their community?
And in your novel, there's a sharp distinction, I would say, between the islanders with their long braided history and the outsiders like Matthew Diamond, the school teacher.
Yeah.
The people who come over from the mainland.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what I tried to do with the novel is, most of the novel is just with the people in the community on the island. Just realize the historical inspiration was just a racially integrated community off of the southern coast of Malaga Island. And in 1912, the state evicted everybody from the island. And so it's always the the complexity of how do you depict the bigotry and the humiliation and all that without the book, with the book just absolutely rejecting that and privileging instead just the lives of these people just trying to make their, you know, trying to be families, trying to be friends, trying to just sort of live their day-to-day lives. And then, but then how to integrate, so you set in relief those day-to-day lives and the qualitative value of the humans on the island with the kind of dehumanizing, degrading sort of outside perspectives of them. And that's where the novel gets a lot of its tension, I think.
Suzanne, I mean, all your characters seem desperate to set down the suitcases of the past.
That's so well put. Well, I think in a funny way, though, that's another way of holding on to it. I mean, each of these characters, I have three main characters, they all have things they are very effectively trying not to think about, trying to seal away. And in that way, they're trying to escape a shock that happened to them. But that is also a pretty effective way of keeping something with you. If you seal it away like that, it stays enormous, it stays powerful, and you're carrying it with you until you can figure out a way to bring it into your life in a more integrated way. So I think the tension is right up there all the time for all three of them. Elizabeth had an interesting response to that question. She says that her book is about the past as nostalgia. And she said for her characters, for me, a lot of the book is about trying to hold on to personal history when it has been exploded and fractured by big history. So photos, songs, small objects, etc., both allowed me as a writer and descendant, because she's writing about her grandmother's history and her grandmother's family, allowed me as a writer and descendant to feel, see, try to touch my characters' lives in the past, and allowed them a mechanism to connect back and hold on. And I think that's another interesting kind of tension. What happens when there's a character who has been displaced and is trying to still live in the place they came from, even though their circumstances are now radically different? And that is what she was trying to do. It's a different kind of tension, but a very potent one.
And I think, Rishi, that applies particularly to Ram, your character, and the poignant letters he's getting from his wife.
I did try to capture some of that. Like, I was trying to, I didn't know how to deal with what Elizabeth was saying there in terms of big history and small history, so I just thought I'd fudge it and put it all in a letter that gets sent overseas periodically, so that way I could use another voice and also be able to summarize big things that had happened, you know, and make them part of the story without taking too much time out to be didactic and boring about it. But I just want to say one thing, Suzanne, what you were saying about that, you know, keep carrying your past around in a suitcase is also, you know, trying to shove it away in a corner, but you know, you're actually retaining it in a way that you would never do if you were actually trying to work through it. That is a character's relationship to their past in some way defines their entire self, that whether a character is able to work through and access things that happened to them in the past and how they play it out in the chronological time of the story versus like this sort of shoving away, that can encapsulate so much of what identifies a character. And I found myself doing that. I have too many main characters. I have four, but of which two are the main leaders of the story. And both of those characters have diametrically opposed relationships with their past. One is going to be like, I just want to go back. I just want to go back. I don't want to be in the here and now. And the other one is just trying to package up in a suitcase and, of course, is not able to do that. So I had never thought of it that way. But how encapsulating it is for an entire character in that relationship to their past.
I mean, when we talk about the pull of the past, I mean, we as writers experience that pull. So one other question I have is, when does the past start to maybe overburden the story and overwhelm the present action? Is that a danger? Or perhaps another way of asking the same question, how is the past revealing the character's current psychological situation?
Another writer once said to me, as long as a character is sitting in a room thinking, I don't have to worry about them. And I thought that was such an interesting way of thinking about that question of how much can be too much, how much backstory can start to drag the narrative down. And I think if you realize your character is burdened by the past, they're burdened by the past in the grocery store, they're burdened by the past in an office party, they're taking it with them everywhere. And so the challenge becomes how to show that, how to allow it to break through whatever it is that they are carrying that is such a heavy load, how to show it in what they're trying to do in their present day lives and how things trigger them, other characters might trigger them. Yeah. I think that can be a more active way sometimes of bringing the past in.
I just want to say, you know, I don't know if Paul had this in terms of writing from a real past in Maine, and I certainly felt it in the Imperial Valley and things that actually had happened then, but there's the past that the character is burdened with, but then there's also the past that we as authors are burdened with, which is that some of these things really happened.
Right.
The tyranny of the truth, that you feel a certain responsibility towards, because you, especially when important things have happened, you know, you feel like, I can't play with that, and I don't want to play with that, even though it's not fitting into my plot line, so what am I going to do? That is a terrific burden, and that's why, you know, it takes 10 or 13 years to write about something like that. But I think I find so much pleasure in the research that I often found that I had things that I had to excise, huge chunks of pieces, but I wonder, too, if that isn't something that enriches the writing ultimately. So
I feel like there's a dynamic, there's a calculus, it's always moving, and that's why I just try to be with just the character in the moment with them, and because thinking about there are historical novels and then there are historical novels, and I was not writing a documentary kind of historical novel for a variety of reasons. So thinking about the tyranny of the truth, and one of the ways that I just think of it is you're writing fiction. So fiction, I feel like every sentence I write has to be true. It's just not necessarily factual, right? So there's an imaginative truth. It's an aesthetic, it's a poetic, it's an artistic kind of truth that has to be of the same grain and in the same spirit as the factual truth. But then when I want to, because of the way that the historical facts are so evocative, in my case, for example, I immediately started thinking about other displacement narratives, from Eden, but also Israel from Egypt. I teach the Old Testament, so I'm always thinking, what would Moses say about that? And just thinking about prophecy and thinking about being displaced and moving and all that sort of thing. So I wanted to, be able to write the novel in a way where those other literary traditions and mythological and folk traditions and everything could exert influence, but in a way that was cooperative, that was in a way that was reinforcing and that amplified. Because from the very beginning of knowing this particular history of this community in Maine, I kept thinking, this is particular history, but it's also American history, and American history particularly in terms of race and the legacy of slavery and that bigotry. And when I've been going all around, literally the world, and just at every reading, somebody always comes up and says, you know what, my grandparents or my ancestors, they lived in a racially integrated community that was kind of founded after the Civil War. It was just astonishing. So it turns into this kind of larger, it becomes in the novel a representative example of this much larger human predicament and situation. And anyway, but in mind, it's set in 1912, but the characters have their own begats and their own Book of Genesis, and the grandmother tells the story that is about, this is how we came to be in this place, this is our island. And then I actually jump forward from 1912, where most of the action takes place, to somewhere around now, and just the kind of troublesome way that retroactively those lives that were destroyed are kind of memorialized and put in kind of a, you know, kind of a nice museum kind of exhibit, which is very, very troubling in its own ways, you know. Yeah. What was the question?
No.
Sorry.
Very, very cool. Can we just loop back to what Rishi said about research? Because we're all writing about things we don't know. And so one of the big questions is, how do we find out about life in another era? How do we somehow evoke felt experience in another era, an era that we can't reach? In my own case, I know it's a continual process of negotiation and recycling many, many delightful things that I can't actually inflict on my readers but can inflict on my friends. But you each have wonderfully vivid details, and I just want to describe a few of them. Suzanne describes how in Holland during World War II they were using wooden bicycle tires because the Nazis were confiscating the rubber tires, and the sound that those wooden tires make on the cobbled streets. Paul has wonderful descriptions of the herbal remedies that are the only kind of medicine that are available to the people on the island, and to a kind of bitter black tea that they sip endlessly to ward off hunger. The hunger is also endless. And Rishi has a wonderful description of a man riding down to the sea to throw away the military medals that the British have awarded him. And he rubs each medal, trying to kind of rub it out before he throws it in the water. And can you just talk a little bit about the research that led you to these wonderful details and this sense of felt experience? And Elizabeth's book, I should say, is marvelous in its in the depth of lived experience across five decades.
I'll just actually say something about Elizabeth's book. She did a lot, just so much research, on top of having taped interviews with her grandmother, who told her about her life, which Elizabeth fictionalized, but she also had actual stories to go with. But she often talked about how much she was finding out that she wasn't going to be able to use. And she went to Cuba, she went to Turkey, she went to Barcelona. She found out so much. She found out too much to put in the book. And the way she and I talked about this at times was that even all that research that you find out and you cannot use adds to the density of the character. It adds to the thickness of the character, which is, I think, what you were referring to, Rishi, too, that it's never wasted work. I think sometimes people will say, well, I wasted months looking into whatever it is. And I think you just get more information about what the character would think, would say, would know, would notice at that point, even if none of it makes itself explicitly into the book.
I would almost say that if you've used every single thing that you've researched, you haven't done enough research. Like, if you were so efficient that that's all you did, I would say, you know, that your characters could have gotten even more depth if you'd done a little more. But, you know, what happened in terms of the writing of Passage West is that I started it in 2007 and I finished in 2019 or something like that. It was 13 years. But over the course of that time, the amount of sociological research that was done by people who had come of age in this country, who had come from South Asia, you know, they had entered their 30s and they were suddenly working towards their PhDs in the field of sociology. So there was a great amount of interest on that first population that came here in the early 1900s. So there were all of these fabulous books that just got added and added that I thought, oh no, I have to read that. I have to read that. And, you know, some of those were about this, about these men, the ex-British soldiers throwing of South Asian descent, just rejecting the British medals that they had received. And that's, you know, they just lobbed them over into the ocean. I made it the Salton Sea because I wanted to stay within a California setting. But, it, you know, the action had happened. So those books were really rich in those kind of facts. And I felt as more of them were coming out that I couldn't wrap up the novel without having read, you know, the vast majority of them at the time, one of whom was written by somebody in the same college I went to, and I rediscovered him years later. So I thought, once I got there, I thought, I've done enough. If I've come back to, you know, my college group of friends, I've done. Yeah.
A lot of that research, I think, ends up allowing you into the sensibility of the time as much as that's possible. I think that is the first thing that disappears about an era, is the sensibility, what it felt like to be alive then. And so that kind of information of what was around people all the time, what they couldn't stop thinking about because it was right there, what they were hearing, what they were smelling, what was in the air, and also what was not there. If you're writing about New York City in 1920 in the summer, air conditioning was not there. So what did that feel like? And that's where a lot of also those details, that sensory information, becomes so critical.
Margot, can I ask a question about that? I mean, Paul, I know you were going to answer, but I just wonder if the two of you use newspapers in a way, you know, to fill in some of that. Even they have holes in them, but at least it's a little more raw, you know, than other information.
I didn't do much research for the book for various reasons, but it's a bit, because it's such an intimate story, and I'm just obsessed with sort of ephemera and small daily things from people's lives, and just what was it like to be at the table when you had this teacup with the tea in it, and we're drinking it, and then 100 years later, that teacup is on a pedestal with beautifully lit and a caption under it, and just like, where did the person go that had that? But in the two or three kind of articles that just laid claim to my imagination about what, you know, this story, headlines from newspaper articles about this community, and they're just so dehumanizing and so degrading. And part of what I do is I include ephemera, so I include sort of state documents and articles, you know, that I write in that kind of degrading, corny, terrible local newspaper kind of prose. I try to, you know, I start with just the person and then just bring the research on a strictly as needed basis to that. And I'm obsessed, you know, with Tinkers even. I'm obsessed with families. For two or three years while I was writing This Other Eden, I kept thinking, oh my God, I'm just rewriting Tinkers. But I just kept thinking, oh, this is just Tinkers Island. But just thinking about like my family photographs, you know, I have the old, like the tin types, the daguerreotypes. Just wonder what was your life like? And then some of the photographs of the folks that lived on the island, it would just be as simple as a woman who looked, you know, older woman sitting in a rocking chair with what, you know, two of her grandchildren on her lap, and just thinking, what are you thinking right now? You know, and I just would imagine, because you're from the photograph's point of view, I just imagine walking around and just getting behind her and after just looking and realizing somebody's taking a picture, 1912, it would be a big, you know, the guy's probably under a thing. And then finally after, you know, getting up the nerve, it's all just showing courtesy to your characters and respecting them. And finally just saying, what do you think about all this? Or what are you thinking? And the first thing she said was, get the hell off of my island. Because it was just invasive to her that, like, nobody comes and does this unless it's something bad, you know. And then from there, maybe I'd find out what kind of a photo, you know, what kind of a camera it would be or whatever. But I don't know if that answers the question. But yeah, just sort of bringing it to each character in each moment, and just what's the kind of least effective dose of that kind of realism to make it feel like it's legit and considerate of that, but it all is in the name of just getting the character to be like an individual human soul right there, right present, you know, in the moment.
Suzanne, you talked about Elizabeth's research, but I don't think you mentioned your research. Would you care to say something?
Well, my book is mostly set in the present, but there is the past that's been very repressed of one character, and it's only a 20 page part of the novel, but it took me so many years to figure it out. And I read so many things and tried to picture myself and in that time period, sort of in the same way that Paul is talking about, though I didn't have any photographs, but I had descriptions from lots of people of that particular time period. And I'd also gone to the Resistance Museum in Amsterdam, which to my surprise was incredibly small. And it was hard to find. It was hidden behind scaffolding. There was very little in it. And that was kind of a shock and was actually quite instructive as I started to try to figure out what had happened to this character that had made her behave the way that she had and made her shut her past off so much. So even though it's a very small part of the book, it actually took a lot of research to get there. But I think, I wish Elizabeth were here because she has photographs in her book. That's a big part of what she was really interested in doing is having this kind of tension between actual family photographs and the fictionalizing that she does in the story. And I think she would have been so interested in the process you were just describing of this kind of the hesitant questions that get you closer and closer to what may imaginatively getting there, what may have mattered to the character. But that I love the tentativeness. I think that that is so respectful and also so rich.
Good way to avoid making characters who are just paper dolls that parrot the lines that you feed them.
Yes.
You know.
I have many more questions, but I would welcome your questions. The panel would welcome your questions. So please, now's the moment. Yes.
You're talking about the past, but what was it about the past that even sparked the writing of these books? Did you just come across something, or have they been haunting you for years? Or?
Excuse me. Could you repeat the question into that microphone that's standing in the aisle so that we can all enjoy it? Thank you.
I was just wondering if you could talk about what of the past sparked the writing of the novels now, and is this something that these things been haunting you for a long time that you finally sat down to see them?
I'll say that it was a topic that haunted me for a long time. Thank you for that question. I had first heard about this group of South Asians who had come over in the early 1900s when I was in law school, and we learned about a group of folks who had been granted U.S. citizenship, and then later on the INS was sued about granting citizenship to a group of Japanese and South Asian men, and it was later taken back. And I, you know, at that time, it was the 1980s, I was just coming of age, and to me it was really important that this group of people had existed before me because my folks had come in after the 1965 surge of immigration from South Asia. So it really did, you used the word haunting, and it really, as I said, from the late 1980s, early 1990s, up until 2006-7 when I started writing, it was like, I felt like I had to do justice to those people. Nobody knew about them, so it stayed with me.
In my case, I guess I was reading histories of labor unions after the Civil War, among other things, labor unions are some of the first institutions in the country to advocate for things like civil rights, women's suffrage, et cetera, because when you have working class communities together, they tend to be more integrated in certain ways. The quintessential example of that is Oakland, the port of Oakland. And that just got me wondering about integrated communities and thinking about integrated communities. I thought there must be, of course there were integrated communities after the Civil War. Yeah, so it says, in my case, the research was so sophisticated, I just literally did a keyword, integrated communities, Civil War, Google, and then just all of these places just started scrolling page after page after page.
And that's how Maine came up?
Maine came up, and I was just like, my family's from Maine, my mom's family's from Maine. That 1912 I had written about kind of a little bit later, but And you know, I just found this history of the island, you know, Malaga, and it was one of those things where I did research. I read two or three articles, and it was so evocative, and I just thought this is so like so central to American history, and so you know, I just started thinking about like a marginalization or whatever. Like, well, whose margins? You know, like it was central to some people, right? You know, so I just started thinking about that. You know, just the sense of like that should not be the margin; that should be the epicenter of the way that America remembers it, thinks about its history, and this sort of thing. Just you know, race in the country, whatever. That, you know, I just started from there, and just started. I actually stopped doing research because one of the things I realized very quickly was that the actual, I don't know if it would be biographical or documentary history of that community is not mine to write. It's just I don't have any connection with it. I was just a novelist who came upon this part of American history, and who it just sort of very quickly just sort of exploded into all these other areas that I of what I teach, what I think about, what I you know read about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I actually just came across it. I guess just another thing that incidentally is when I was finding out about these folks, is one family on the island was committed to a place called the Main School for the Feeble-Minded. You can imagine the delights that await, that, you know. One of the characters in Tinkers, which is based on my family, had ended up being, was in danger of being committed to pretty much the same school. I had based it on that same thing. And then I found out that almost to the I think it was the summer of 1912, July of 1912, when the people were being kicked off the island, the first international congress on eugenics was taking place in London. Yeah. And I just thought, yeah, I can't sleep. Like literally, just all you know. So I just started apprenticing myself, you know, to that story.
Oh, just extremely briefly, I grew up knowing a woman who had done something very heroic during World War II, and she was incredibly cold and remote and impossible to know and had a terrible relationship with her children. And I was always intrigued by this woman who was a hero in a big way, but was inaccessible to her family. And I just was always fascinated by her.
Thank you. More questions?
Yeah, so you've all been to the locations, I guess, where you your books take place. And I'm wondering if there are any stories or any things that really enlightened you just by being in that environment, you know, seeing things that maybe changed the direction or, you know, just anything about that location.
To go back in time and to that place, it weirdly, you know, I was born in India. It was a journey to feeling like I belonged here, you know, to have a group of men and very few women who were involved in building this country and the agricultural work that they did here. And then for 4 or 5 decades have had nobody come from, you know, that part of Asia to here, and then for my family to come, it was the bridge that I needed. It was very, very important to me on a personal level to know about them.
The action in my novel all takes place on Lake Champlain in a very small, very uncomfortable cottage that has a huge window facing the lake. And for me, that lake was a place where the characters could all project things that they couldn't really think about otherwise. That big, beautiful, lit area was, even that huge area couldn't hold all the things that they couldn't allow themselves to think about. So the place itself was important for me as a kind of a contrast to how closed off they were in their minds. To have this enormous lit space right in front of them was actually very useful.
In my case, I didn't go to the locale, partly because, again, I just had, it was a very, you know, delicate balance between taking the part of that story that is, say, public domain, it's history, it's common history, but then being very, very aware that it's also local history, and was very, very, wanted to be utterly tactful. I wanted the book to be a, you know, a gesture of courtesy and respect, and you know, like an overture of just like, again, just, yeah, courtesy, dignity, respect, that sort of thing. And so I was just very tentative about, at one point, there was an article being done about, just like a profile piece, and they wanted me to go up to the island and be photographed there, and I was like, no, I'm not, who's that jerk taking our, you know, like, no way, you know, I feel, you know, sort of tentative enough, but also just sort of, and just fortunate that I found out about that story and wanted to write a, you know, a novel that was based on it without like having other voice. You know, it's not meant to be the definitive history of that place. It's meant to be mine, is a voice and a book that is meant to be part of like what ends up being a larger dialogue and discussion about our history and about our country and all that sort of stuff. So I was very much on the side of, you know, trying to be tactful.
It's interesting because you can't really go back. You know, I mean, we can talk about the light on Lake Champlain, or you can talk about the gesture, but you can't go back to that time and place. So even if you think a physical trip there, you can't ever replicate what it is you're writing, which I found very frustrating.
Yeah.
But it's, you know.
More questions? Things people would like to.
I'm sorry. I had also just sort of following on that thought and the way that you each have reached back to a past, and you know, what was that struggle like between whose past is it and who sort of owns that past? I think for each of you, you may have more or less of a personal connection and attachment and maybe right to the past. And so, you know, can you talk a little bit about what that struggle was for you as you're trying to frame it with characters' past that overlap some pasts that are true and not your own?
I again wish Elizabeth were here because this was such a live question for her, because she was writing about her actual family. In some cases, she used their actual names. One of her great uncles was still alive and gave her permission. He wanted his name to be used, but she was very aware that these were their lives that she was trying to dream her way into. On the other hand, this was her past too. And she wanted to make sure that the stories her grandmother had told her didn't disappear, that this particular group of Sephardic Jews who left Turkey to go to Barcelona, to Spain, that had ejected them centuries before, but tried to make a life there and then went from there to the United States, that this story got told. But she was always aware of the possibility of overstepping. And one of the reasons she kept doing so much research, I think, and wanted to go back to the places they had actually lived, was to try to keep herself in line so that she had some physical check or literal check on some of the ways she was imagining. And she was worried about romanticizing some of the things that had happened to them. At the same time, she wanted to celebrate it. As she said, this book is about nostalgia, of trying to hold on to something. But it was really a very present issue for her. That's a great question.
For me, it was complicated because in sort of mainstream America, it was easy to identify as Indian and therefore be aligned with this group of men that I was writing about. But actually, among the Indian sub-community, you know, I'm not Punjabi, I'm not a man. And I'm not Sikh. You know, I was raised in a Hindu household. So I had this dual thing going on in my relationship to my characters, where, you know, one group of folks, probably the majority readers of the book initially at least, were going to think I was completely aligned with the community that, and another group was like, who the hell are you to write this story about us? So it was happening simultaneously. So the only way that I could think to fix that inside my own head was to form a really strong relationship with the elderly children of the people that I was writing about. And they were extremely gracious and welcoming to me. And they were also children who had Mexican mothers and Punjabi fathers. So they felt that they had a great mixing amongst themselves. And so we're so happy to have somebody, I think, generally write and commemorate their story. Like even today, I feel so privileged to have sat, you know, in their dining rooms and shared meals with them, and they tell me their family. So I felt very much that I was in service of them. I feel the book is in service of them, and not about this other. It was important to me personally, but I feel ultimately like the only people I really cared about what they thought about that book were these people, some of whom have now passed, that I met when they were in their 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like the, even just like the language of ownership or something, it's just it's never even, it was just, you know, a respectful guest or something like that, yeah. You know, I don't know, you know, the idea of that it's, there's no, you know, I didn't feel any entitlement, like I had to earn, you know, writing that book and earn being able to write about these characters. And, you know, what I thought is the best I could, if the novel works, it will be, I'm writing a tender-hearted novel that's set in a cold-hearted world, you know, and that the book is about the human persons. It's what it's always about. It's not about the violence, it's not about, you know, it's the means by which those people were objectified and they're dehumanized. You know, I feel like if there's one thing that is my job as an artist or as a writer, it's to subjectify people, resubjectify people out of that kind of. And then there were, you know, just strange things. While I was writing it, editors who ended up not editing the book for reasons that will be on, you know, would say things to me like, well, why don't you just make everybody on the island white? So, talk about erasure, are you fucking kidding? So, excuse my French. But it was just this absurd sort of like, you know, and then you'd slowly realize, like, oh, what they really want me to do is write a novel about a bunch of 55-year-old straight white guys playing golf or something. Like that's just not, you know. And over all those years, in continual conversation with friends and colleagues, former students, you know, writers who were black, who were mixed race, who were trans, LGBT, you know, whatever. They would say, you know, I tell them it was kind of, that was one of the headwinds that was going on. And they would say, well, you know, those same editors are telling us that we can only write about that kind of identity, you know, my identity. You know, it's like, I want to write a thriller, but they won't let me write a thriller. You know, so it just occurred to me that what there is a very subtle but very stark in some ways instance of kind of segregation going on, and just saying, like, look, if this book is going to come out in this country right now and burn up before it even gets into the atmosphere, I'm going to do it trying to make a gesture of dialogue, yeah, and connection, and like, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer would say, a token of recognition and friendship among friends. And if it didn't, I'd rather have it flame out that way than like capitulate to that baloney, you know.
Thank you. I think we have time for maybe one more question. You were going to ask something?
This is just a quick question about how you write dialogue in the past. And do you actually try to stay in the past, or do you let your characters live in that way? How does it bring them to life in dialogue?
I think you have to come to terms with you're just going to screw it up. It's the whole thing about writing the novel in the first place. You have to sit down and just be like, this whole thing is going to be imperfect. I'm just going to screw up the whole thing. That's the only way that you can write the first sentence of dialogue, quite honestly. You know, the whole exercise is about smooshing your own ego. Squash, you know.
I remember the first pages my grandmother saw of Tinkers, which was about the generation. And the first thing she said was, your great-grandfather didn't own a mule, it was a horse. And she was outraged. And I was like, oh, my God. Yeah. The way I get, one of the things, maybe with dialogue, I think one of the things that I felt like I learned is that you don't learn how to write dialogue and then deploy it. You learn how to listen to each character and what they say and the way they say it. Very, very different, you know. Although people ask, you know, how did you get the, you know, the, it sounds so archaic and Tinkers and this other Eden. And basically, it's like I just have the characters speak grammatically correct English with no contractions. You know, and that's kind of archaic, you know. But I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that.
Suzanne, before we end, would you like to?
Oh, to weigh in on that?
Yes.
I mean, I know a writer who just writes Venice, 1875, and then figures that that's going to just do everything like that. You know, he doesn't have to do any more. I think, you know, sticking to, again, what the characters are dealing with all the time is going to start to change how they talk. You know, that what they're looking at, what kind of work they do, what's around them constantly, the things that they're handling, that itself is going to get into the language of how they're speaking. So I agree.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming today.
I hope you
have a fabulous day at the Boston Book Festival.
Thank you, Margo.
And stay and talk to our authors, admire their books, enjoy yourselves. Thank you.